It's always a pleasure to come to Santa Barbara. So I'd like to describe some work that's taken place recently on superconformal theories in three dimensions that have a Chern-Simon structure. So I'll start with a rather general introduction and just remind you that in the original ADS-CFT story, there are three examples given that have maximal supersymmetry, meaning 32 conserved supercharges. And I refer to them here as M2, D3, and M5 dualities because those are the types of brains that give rise to these things. So the duality that's associated with the two brains in M-theory are on the one hand, what one gets from the near horizon geometry of those M2 brains is M-theory on four-dimensional anti-de Sitter space times a seven sphere. And then the dual conformal field theory it's supposed to have maximal supersymmetry, and it's three-dimensional, and should have the same symmetries as the solution of M-theory. And that symmetry is given by the supergroup, OSP8/4. So the bosonic subgroup is SO8, which is the R symmetry of the conformal field theory, and it's the isometry of the seven sphere. And then there's also an SP4 subgroup, which is a non-compact group, which is the covering group of SO3, 2. That's the conformal group in three dimensions, and it's also the isometry group of a four-dimensional anti-de Sitter space-time. So we're just going up in dimension, and then one dimension higher is the most studied example. That's the duality associated with D3 brains. And in this case, the near horizon geometry of the D3 brains is given by type 2B superstring theory on ADS5 times S5. And then this is supposed to be dual to a maximally supersymmetric superconformal field theory in four dimensions. And that theory turns out to be N equal 4 super Yang-Mills theory. And the supergroup that gives the isometry of this type 2B solution and the superconformal symmetry of the Yang-Mills theory is the PSU 2, 2/4. So the bosonic subgroup is an SU 2, 2, which is the conformal group in four dimensions or the isometry of ADS5, and the SU4, which is the covering group of SO6, which is the isometry of S5, and the R symmetry group of the N equal 4 super Yang-Mills. So the same kind of story is here. And then the third example, which should be listed for completeness, is M-theory on ADS7 times S4. That's the near horizon geometry of a stack of M5 brains in M-theory. And then that's supposed to be dual to a maximally supersymmetric superconformal field theory in six dimensions. And the supergroup in this case is OSP 6, 2/4. So here the conformal group is the O6, 2. And the SP4 is taken in a compact form. That's the covering group of SO5, which is the isometry of the four sphere and the R symmetry of this superconformal field theory. So these are the famous three examples that you can find in Wan's original paper on this stuff. So the by far the most studied of these three examples is the type 2B N equal 4 super Yang-Mills duality. And in this case, both the conformal field theory, which is SUN N equal 4 super Yang-Mills theory, is well understood. And so is the dual string theory solution, which is type 2B superstring theory in this geometry. And so one has several things going for oneself in this business. One is that one can study the Yang-Mills theory perturbatively, and one can also do a large N with Hooft expansion, where the Hooft parameter is given in terms of the rank of the gauge group by G squared N, and in the duality that's dual to the radius to the fourth power, where the radius characterizes the size of the ADS5 or the S5. The scaling with R to the fourth is easy to understand. The self-dual 5 form flux that one has in ADS5 times S5, just on dimensional grounds, has to be 1 over the radius times the volume of the volume form on the 5-sphere plus the volume form on the ADS-5. And so the total flux N is just given by integrating this over the 5-sphere, and the 5-sphere has volume r to the fifth. So r to the fifth times 1 over r gives you r to the fourth. And that's how you see that N is proportional to r to the fourth. So that's the much understood example. In the planar approximation, large N fixed lambda, the N equal 4 super Yang-Mills theory is believed to be given by an integrable spin chain model. There's a lot of evidence for that. And furthermore, the type 2B superstring theory on ADS-5 times S-5 in this limit is described in tree approximation. So the tree approximation in the string theory is the same thing as large N in the gauge theory, and is again supposed to be described by an integrable world sheet action. So on both sides of the duality in this limit, one has something that looks like it could be completely soluble. And as a result of a great deal of ingenious work by many people, the equivalence of these two integrable theories has been largely, but not completely, demonstrated. And there's certainly no doubt that it's true. So I would say that this duality is in pretty good shape. And so that left as a question, what about the two dualities that have to do with M-theory, which have just as much supersymmetry and are in much poorer shape? So the two M-theory dualities are much tougher. First of all, M-theory is less well understood than type 2B superstring theory, and for a very simple reason, namely it doesn't have a perturbation expansion. So in type 2B string theory, there's a string coupling constant, which arises as the vacuum expectation value of the dilaton. M-theory doesn't have any scalar field with an expectation value. It doesn't have any scalar, massless scalar field. No. And so you can't do perturbation theory. And furthermore, the dual superconformal field theories, both in 3 dimensions and in 6 dimensions, were much more elusive. And until recently, the 3-dimensional one wasn't known, and the 6-dimensional one is still not known. Well, one has indirect ways of describing these things, but they weren't known in a direct sort of way, like I'll be discussing. So within the past year, there's been a lot of progress in formulating the 3-dimensional superconformal field theory that's dual to M theory on ADS-4 times S-7, as well as certain orbifold generalizations, which turn out to be very interesting and important. And so I want to describe those developments. So I got interested in this question a few years ago, 2004, and I wrote a paper describing my failed attempts to solve the problem, which, in hindsight, I'm glad I did, because people have found it interesting, even though it failed. and so the idea was that the 3-dimensional superconformal field theories that are dual to M theory on ADS-4 times a 7-dimensional compact space should be gauge theories in which the Yang-Mills fields appear only in covariant derivatives and in Chern-Simons terms. So I just remind you, a Chern-Simons term is given as an integral of a Chern-Simons 3 form, and the Chern-Simons 3 form is best understood as being the 3 form whose exterior derivative is trace of F wedge F. Now, this is not gauge invariant. However, what you can do is to ensure that under large gauge transformations that S is well-defined modulo 2 pi, since it's e to the is that goes into the path integral. So if S is well-defined modulo 2 pi, then that's good enough to say that you have gauge invariance. And that's built in by taking this coefficient k to be an integer. So k is called the level of the Chern-Simons theory. And so as long as k is an integer, you have a gauge invariant theory when this is part of the action. Now, there's been a lot of work on pure Chern-Simons theory, and that's not what we're interested in here. We're interested in coupling these gauge fields to propagating matter. So the important point is that this is dimension 3, and so there are no dimensionful parameters in this expression, so it has scale invariance. Now, if one were to put in a conventional kinetic term for the gauge fields, the integral of f squared, that would not be scale invariant in three dimensions. That's nicely scale invariant in four dimensions, because f squared has dimension four in any dimension. So it's only in four dimensions that that such a term can be a part of a scale invariant theory. So we don't want this term. So we simply don't include it.
I'm a little confused. I mean, normally when we do dimensional analysis, we fix the mass dimension of a field by saying that, I mean, in any dimension, that the kinetic term
has
the right dimension. So why are you assuming that even in three
dimensions? Right, very good. So I'll pull out a piece of chalk from this box here, and then I will tell you the answer, if I can get the box open. I'll destroy it, and that'll open it. Okay. So if one defines the gauge field this way, where you put a parameter 1 here, which you can do by scaling A, then you've used up all your freedom of rescaling by making this a 1. And then A has to have the same dimension as the D, which makes it dimension 1, and then this has dimension 2. So in the case of maximal supersymmetry, the seven-dimensional compact space is a seven-sphere. More generally, what one wants is that it's a Sasaki-Einstein seven-manifold, so that the cone over it is a Calabi-Yau fourfold. In this case, the cone over it is flat space, R8. Okay. But in any case, this is the only example that would give you the maximal supersymmetry. Any of the other Sasaki-Einsteins would give you less supersymmetry. And here I want to focus on having a lot of supersymmetry. So we want matter in our superconformal field theory. And since the gauge fields are only appearing in the Chern-Simons term and not in a kinetic term, they're not propagating degrees of freedom. So we don't count them for just deciding how many scalars and spinners we have. And so we want an equal number of scalars x and spinners psi just to have the possibility of having supersymmetry. And of course, they go into one another under the supersymmetry. And the supersymmetry parameter one sees from this group transforms as an 8 of the SO8. Of course, SO8 has three inequivalent 8s, which are related by triality. And which one one uses for which purpose is a matter of convention. But it's conventional to think of the spinners. We don't have to do it, but you can. Anyway, we think of the as the supercharges as belonging to a spinorial 8. And then one of these fields has to belong to the other spinorial 8, and the other one is to the vector 8. So it's kind of conventional to make this the vector 8, because that's what you think of when you think of the 8 transverse directions to it. M2 brain in 11 dimensions. Think of that as an 8 vector. So the kinds of terms that our scale invariant action can contain are kinetic terms for the scalars, kinetic terms for the spinners, and various interactions. So from here, we see that this is dimension 3 if x has dimension 1/2. This is dimension 3 if psi has dimension 1. And then you can see that that these expressions are also dimension 3. So the theory is going to contain these four types of terms. These are covariant derivatives involving the gauge fields. And of course, there are all sorts of indices and coefficients and so on, which are not shown in this line here. And so you're going to have this plus this Chern-Simons term, and that'll be the whole theory.
How about the spinor?
Well, I want Lorentz scalars also. So that's the structure of the terms. So what I tried in 2004 was just to write down actions with that structure and with n equal 8 supersymmetry, just by brute force, don't think hard. And I made some assumptions, which turned out to be wrong. And the assumption I made was that it would work just the way the N equal 4 super Yang-Mills does in four dimensions, where you have a SUN gauge group, and the matter belongs to the adjoint representation. So I just tried it and did brute force. And a whole bunch of terms worked, and I was excited. And then when I got to the more complicated interactions, it didn't work. And I was puzzled, because I'd never had that happen to me before. So anyway, then I wrote a paper. So that's what I did. And then the breakthrough, which kind of got this business going, was by Bagger and Lambert a year ago. And much of what they did was done independently by a fellow named Gustafson. So they found a theory for which you do have the N equal 8 supersymmetry realized on this kind of a theory. But curiously, the theory that they found is one whose physical interpretation is still unclear today. So even though their mathematics is right, and it's an interesting example, it isn't really the theory. The theory they found is not what one wants to describe M2 brains, it appears. However, the paper that's made everything clear, and certainly is correct, was written by Aharoni, Bergman, Jaffris, and Maldacena last June. And so this is known as ABJM, and it already has well over 100 citations. Okay, so what did Bagger and Lambert do? So they set up some mathematical machinery where they worked with generalizations of a Lie algebra, where instead of having a bracket with two generators giving you one generator, they have a bracket with three generators giving you one generator. Now, these kinds of mathematical structures have been studied before. They weren't the first people in the world to think about such things, but they were the first ones to find an interesting physical application. So the idea is that, so they insisted that this bracket should have total antisymmetry. So we have antisymmetry in ABCD, in ABC. And they also required, so the rules I'm giving you are what they needed in order that their action that they wrote down should have the full supersymmetry. So they found that this thing has to have ABC symmetry. They found that there has to be a generalization of the Jacobi identity. And the generalization of the Jacobi identity, which clearly generalizes to N algebras, so they call this a 3 algebra, and it generalizes to N algebras. And if for a 2 algebra, it reduces to the usual Jacobi. So as you define an operation, add sub x comma y, this way is acting on z. And then you require that this is a derivation. And what those fancy words mean is that this is equal to this plus this plus this. So if you do the same kind of thing for a 2 algebra, it'll give you the Jacobi identity. And they needed one more thing. They needed that there has to be a metric associated with this algebra. So what does that mean? It means a symmetric tensor, HAB, that's invertible, so it's non-degenerate. And so you can use it for raising and lowering indices. And if you raise this last index with this thing, then they require that this object should have total antisymmetry. So this is something that's very familiar with compact Lie algebras. We do that sort of thing all the time. So they gave an example of a realization, which I will show you. The realization that Bagger and Lambert found is basically where we have a gauge group is SO4, and the scalars and spinors transform as 4 vectors of the gauge. So that's something I didn't find, A, because I wasn't considering orthogonal groups, I was considering unitary groups, and B, because I wanted my matter to be adjoint, and here it was fundamental. So I was wrong on two ways. Anyway, shortly after they found that example, there was a theorem written in two separate papers by these people, and the theorem was that the example they found was the only example. So the more precise statement is if you assume everything I've told you, and furthermore, you assume that this metric H is positive definite, then there's only one non-trivial example of such a three algebra. And it's given where FABCD is the usual epsilon symbol, total antisymmetry. So it's just ABCD just going run from 1 to 4. And the metric is the Kronecker delta. And up to the usual redefinitions and stuff, that's the only non-trivial example. A trivial example would be of algebra with just one generator, which leads to a free theory. So the most general and N equal 8 theory you can construct according to this theorem is an arbitrary combination of SO4 algebras, which just don't talk to each other, and a bunch of free theories. Okay. So the SO4 theory is the only non-trivial example according to this theorem. So what does the theory look like? So I'll tell it to you in more generality, as if you could have other algebras, even though this is the other realizations. So for every such three algebra, they write down a supersymmetric theory. So you can take the scalars and spinors to be algebra valued, just to make a more compact notation if you wish, belonging, as I said, to 8 vector and 8 conjugate spinor representations of the spin 8 R symmetry group. Then there are gauge fields, which are given this way. So you see, since A and B go from 1 to, when they go from 1 to 4, you see these are just associated with the generators of an orthogonal group. They also find it convenient to define an A tilde this way.
So on this one detail, which is, did Dagger number leave this H3 positive definite, or was that just an extra assumption?
Okay. So if, we'll come back to this point later, but if it is not positive definite, then you're going to have kinetic terms with the wrong sign, because the metric is used for in the construction of the kinetic terms. So Lagrangian is the sum of three pieces, kinetic terms, interaction terms, and the Chern-Simons term. And I just throw away an overall constant, which we'll put back in the definition of this thing. So the kinetic term is given here. And here you see, just the point I was just making, that these kinetic terms here, are you can track the indices using this metric. And so as long as this is positive definite, then all these things have the usual signs. And if there are any negative eigenvalues, then you're going to have wrong sign kinetic terms, which usually one doesn't want. And the covariant derivative is defined this way, which is the usual thing, and similarly for the spinner. And the interaction terms are here. So there's the thing which is sixth order in the scalar fields, and the one that's has two scalar fields and two spinner fields, which is given this way, where this Dirac matrix is an SO8 Dirac matrix. In between. So that acts on, so there's gamma. So what did I do here? I did something screwy. What I should have said, yeah, because the alpha and the beta are the spinner indices of the SO8. So what I should have said is gamma ij alpha beta, and then this should be an alpha and this should be a beta. Yeah, so that's not quite right as written, which I now realize. Okay. And the Chern-Simons term, up to some factor of k over 4 pi or something, is this. And this is not the usual Chern-Simons term I showed you before, because it's got these extra f's in it. They call it a twisted Chern-Simons term. But it works like the ordinary ones. And this was a little puzzling when just presented as an abstract result. But this is what they needed to get all the supersymmetry working. So that looks a little strange. So let's just look at this specific example where we know that all this makes sense. So we turn to this SO4 theory where we have this 4-generator 3 algebra with SO4 gauge symmetry. And then you can do the obvious thing and rewrite it as an SU2 times SU2 theory. So if you do that, then this twisted Chern-Simons term becomes intelligible. And what you discover is that it's the difference of the usual Chern-Simons terms for the two SU2 factors. So it's an interesting fact that there's a relative minus sign between the two Chern-Simons terms for the two different SU2s, and that's what all those fancy Fs mean in this particular realization. And of course, there's this quantized coupling constant with the level, the Chern-Simons level, which can be built into the formula as I showed you, just as a multiplicative factor. That's a convenient way of describing it because you don't have to carry these things around when you're checking classical symmetries of the theory. You can rescale fields to more canonical forms if you want, but then k's will appear sprinkled through the formulas. Now, one interesting fact about this minus sign between these two Chern-Simons terms is that this theory is parity conserving. And that's important because we know in the M theory construction that the things we're looking for are reflection symmetrical. And the way the parity works is interesting. You see, the Chern-Simons term has the epsilon symbol in it, which gives you a minus sign under spatial reflection. So what you have to do is to define parity as combining that spatial reflection with interchange of the two SU2 factors. So if you choose to define your parity operation that way, that is an honest-to-goodness Z2 symmetry of the theory that involves spatial reflection. And that would then imply that if there is a dual ADS theory, that it should be reflection symmetrical. Now, many people raised the question that was raised over here a moment ago, and that is, since this unique algebra that this SO4 theory is the unique solution for a positive definite metric, and we clearly want to be able to describe n M2 brains, so we have to do something better than this. And so people started looking at Lorentzian three algebras. And what a Lorentzian three algebra means is that this metric, HAB, is allowed to have one negative eigenvalue and the rest of them positive. So that's what they mean by Lorentzian. And three different groups did this at the same time. I didn't even bother to write down all their names. I was not party to any of them. So they all found the same thing, so it's certainly right. And the three algebras they constructed contain a compact semisimple Lie algebra. So you can pick any compact semisimple Lie algebra, and then you add, so that gives you the dimension of that Lie algebra, the dimension number of generators, and then you add two more generators that you call T plus and T minus. So you have generators TA, which are the generators of the Lie algebra, and then you add T plus and T minus. And so those are all your complete set of generators, and out of them you can construct a three algebra with Lorentzian signature. So the way it's defined is that the structure constant F plus ABC is defined to be just the structure constant of the Lie algebra G. And all the other non-zero components of this thing are given by permuting indices or raising and lowering indices with the H. So you can deduce all of the other non-zero ones from this one. And so the only other thing I have to specify is what is H. So on the Lie algebra generators, it's just Kronecker delta. So we're describing the Lie algebra in this usual basis where that's the Cartan metric. And then just to get one plus and one minus eigenvalue, they just define the other three things, H plus minus, H plus plus, and H minus minus, to take these values. So the 2x2 matrix of these things will have one positive and one negative eigenvalue. Okay. So if we consider now taking the Bagger-Lambert general formulas that I showed you, remember the various fields are then labeled by these generators. So if we focus on the fields that are associated with the minus generator in this construction, the minus actually is not the same as plus, so let me make that point clear. Because of the way we introduced the structure constants here, plus is treated differently from minus. As far as the 2x2 submatrix is concerned, here, it looks the same. But it's not the same in the rest of the algebra. So saying that I'm doing minus is not the same thing saying I'm doing plus. And so anyway, if you focus on the complete dependence on these fields, it's just given by these kinetic terms. The pluses also appear in the interaction terms, but the minuses don't. And so it's obvious that these describe propagating ghost degrees of freedom. Because if I went to a diagonal basis, this would be the difference of two things, and this would be the difference of two things. So, in my opinion, that makes the theory unsatisfactory. In these earlier three papers, some of them tried to argue that you could make sense of this, but they later withdrew that claim. However, one of them made a very important observation, and that is that this is invariant under a shift of x minus, a constant shift, since that's the only place where x minus appears. It's also, they didn't say it, but it's obvious, it's also invariant under a constant shift of psi minus. So what my students and I did was to modify the theory by adding some more terms containing two new gauge fields, which we called C and chi. Well, chi doesn't look like a gauge field, but it acts like one. So the new terms we added were these two terms. And these two terms did one thing that's obvious and one that's not so obvious. The obvious thing they did was they gauged that global symmetry to turn it into a local symmetry. So that was the idea of adding these terms. And when you add these two terms to the previous expression, then these constant shifts here by a bosonic parameter or a fermionic parameter when combined with these transformations of the gauge fields, then become local symmetries. So that part's obvious. The thing that's not quite so obvious is that adding these terms doesn't break any of the symmetries, and you still have the full OSP8/4 symmetry even with these extra terms added. So the advantage of doing that is then you can then use the gauge symmetries to use the gauge choices x minus and psi minus are 0. So this is the old Stuckelberg mechanism. And this eliminates the kinetic terms for the ghosts. So we know now there are no longer any ghosts in the theory. And furthermore, the equations of motion that come from varying the gauge fields then are just these. So psi plus is 0 and x plus is a constant. So in choosing this constant, you can use the SO8 symmetry to make it point in a particular direction, say the 8 direction. And so the only question that remains is whether it's 0 or not 0. Now, if you choose the x plus to be 0, then you're left with a free theory. And that's because the x plus appears in the interaction terms. And so that's kind of uninteresting. So we would like to have an interacting theory. So you want to take x plus to not be 0. But then that means, since it has to point in a particular direction, that breaks the SO8R symmetry to an SO7 subgroup. So that's what I just... So we choose it to point in the 8 direction with a size V. Now, when you do that, and you just plug in the formulas and do some simple-minded classical manipulations, no quantum physics here, just do some classical manipulations. You can integrate out some fields that you identify as auxiliary fields, and so on and so forth. And then by the time the dust settles, you find that what you've got is precisely N equal 8 super Yang-Mills theory, with the group G that you put into this 3 algebra, and with this Yang-Mills coupling constant given by this V. Remember, X had dimension 1/2, and that is the correct dimension for the Yang-Mills coupling constant in 3 dimensions.
So breaking the SO8 automatically broke the conformal symmetry as well?
So that's right. So this breaks spontaneously breaks the conformal symmetry. So what has one done here? One has written good old n equal 8 super Yang-Mills theory in three dimensions in a way where it looks like it has conformal invariance, but any attempt to make sense of it forces you to break that conformal symmetry and get back to the usual description. So you can write almost any theory you can imagine to look like it has conformal symmetry by similar trickery, and it really is not a profound observation. So all this is right. This is the correct theory, but it's not helpful, because the original problem was to find the conformal field theory that's dual to M2 brains, or that corresponds to M2 brains, the dual to ADS4 times S7. And it's been known for a long time, and it's just the limit of the theory that lives on D2 brains, and the limit where the transverse 2A circle gets large. But that just means that it's precisely the strong coupling limit of N equal 8 super Yang-Mills theory, the infrared fixed point. And that's exactly what you do when you let this V go to infinity, as you approach the infrared fixed point of N equal 8 super Yang-Mills theory. So that's all correct, but we knew this already. So we've gone in some giant circle. And we're right back where we started. So when we wrote this up, we ended on kind of on a note of disappointment that this long exploration was kind of pointless, because we right back where we started.
Did fluctuation of the x plus I, because it's massless, you know, you just take the day, but there's a zero mode still there in this theory?
Well, there's no. You see, the before you put in, before you made the symmetry local, like we did, then indeed it would have satisfied some free wave equation. But after we added these extra terms, which gauged that shift symmetry, the equation of motion was no longer the wave equation. It was just that the first derivative was zero. And that just means it's a constant. So there are no fluctuations. It's just a constant. So, the hope was that one could find something that's analogous to a Seiberg dual, where you have another description of this large coupling limit of the super Yang-Mills theory, which gives you an expression with finite parameters and an explicit classical Lagrangian that gives you that strong coupling limit as in another description, which is right, exactly right. So that's why it was disappointing to get back to where you started in this way. So I was ready to drop the business at that point, but then there was this ABJM paper. So to just before telling you about the ABJM, let me tell you about attempts that had been made to understand the Bagger-Lambert SO4 theory. So to understand what its physical interpretation is, you can look at what the group is. And you can also look at the moduli space of solutions and try to see what that would correspond to in terms of brains moving along around in some kind of geometry. And so what these people concluded was that the Bagger-Lambert theory at level k describes two M2 brains at an orbifold singularity, a ZK orbifold symmetry. So C4 mod ZK, or you can talk about S7 mod ZK. That's the same thing. So their idea was basically correct, but it turns out the Bagger-Lambert theory isn't exactly the right theory to be talking about. So they had the right explanation, but the wrong theory. And so the right theory was found by these people. And so before describing what they did, let me just say a little more about the orbifold. So to define this orbifold, you just take four complex parameters. You can think of these parameters as describing the eight dimensions transverse to M2 brains in 11 dimensions. So you think of that as four complex spaces. And if you simultaneously rotate in each of these four planes by an angle of 2 pi over k, then you identify the rotated configuration with the original one, then you're creating some kind of conical deficit there, and these identifications give you this C4 mod ZK orbifold. And this orbifold action clearly breaks the SO8R symmetry down to an SU4, which related to SO6. And, well, for general K, if K is 1, you haven't done anything, so you should still have the full SO8. And it turns out if K equals 2, when you're just doing a rotation by pi, you still haven't broken the R symmetry, even in that case, and you still have SO8. But if K is greater than 2, you've broken the R symmetry down to SO6. And you can also study spinners on such a space. And you can argue that the 8 supersymmetries that you have before the orbifolding, that after this orbifolding, when K is greater than 2, that 2 of the supersymmetries are broken and 6 are preserved. I won't give you the analysis on that, but basically the idea is that this 8 breaks up as 1 plus 6 plus 1, and the 6 is neutral under the extra U1 that's inside there. So for K greater than 2, one doesn't want the full N equal 8 supersymmetry. One only wants N equals 6 supersymmetry. And so the conclusion is that if we generalize our initial problem of trying to find a dual conformal field theory to ADS4 times S7 mod ZK, which is suggested by this construction, then the symmetry of this, and therefore of the dual conformal field theory, is OSP 8 slash 4 when K is equal to 1 or 2, but is only OSP 6 slash 4 when K is greater than 2. And so the same has to be true in the dual conformal field theory. So what ABJM do is to construct a field theory that has manifest N equals 6. And since the level K can be pulled out as an overall factor in the construction, at the classical level, you don't really distinguish different values of K. And so the fact that the symmetry should be extended for K equal 1 and 2 is very subtle and quantum mechanical. It hasn't to this day been proved, but everyone believes it. So in the ABJM theory, they construct N equals 6 superconformal Chern-Simons theories.
Just as sort of historical, but out of curiosity, so did AB and JNM actually use this argument as their motivation for looking at N equals 6, or were they just trying to find the most supersymmetry that they could put into a Chern-Simons theory?
No, they understood. They understood this from all angles.
It wasn't sort of an
from all angles. They give a very thorough discussion from every viewpoint. It's a great paper. So in their construction, the gauge group is UN times UN, and the matter is bifundamental. Very similar to what we had in Biger-Lambert, because there the 4 vector of SO4 is bifundamental when you talk about SU2 times SU2. But there one subtle difference is it's UN times UN, it's not SUN times SUN. And it's all N. Which is possible for N equals 6. You couldn't even do U2 times U2. See, Biger-Lambert is SU2 times SU2. Even U2 times U2 is not possible for N equal 8. The extra U1s are not trivial, or at least one combination of them is not trivial, because bifundamental matter is charged under one of those U1s. So N, of course, as usual, corresponds to the number of flux units in the dual story. So you integrate the dual of F4, which is a 7-4, you integrate that over your 7-dimensional compact space, which is S7 mod ZK. And that's up to your normalization conventions, is N. Of course, on the covering space, if you integrate it over S7, you would be taking K copies of this. So over the covering space, you would have KN units of flux. And The covering space is relevant if you want to repeat the argument I gave earlier for relating to the radius of the ADS and the sphere. And so one learns that the radius scale is like kn to the 1/6. Or if you like, kn is proportional to r to the 6th. So remember, for n equal 4 super Yang-Mills, I showed you that n is proportional to r to the 4th. So this statement is the analog of that. Now their construction, if you just look at the field theory they write down, their construction works perfectly fine for SUN times SUN. It doesn't have to be. You can certainly have nice n equals 6 theories with this group. And in the special case where here you choose n equal 2, it is the Bagger-Lambert theory, and there is an added symmetry, and you really do have n equal 8 supersymmetry. But the extra U1 factors are required to get the right orbifold action working in the gauge theory. And so you don't hit you don't get quite the right moduli space without it.
Does that mean that we have some interpretation for these SUN cross SUN theories where k equals 1 in terms of that?
No, we really don't. And I mean, all I can say is that in the case of n equal 4 super Yang-Mills, you can write down such theories for all sorts of gauge groups, and it's only certain classes for which we have a nice dual interpretation. And so it seems to me that one just has to say that sometimes there is a dual interpretation, sometimes there isn't. So following this great paper of ABJM, my students and I made a very minor contribution to the subject. And what we did was just to explicitly verify that their action had the full advertised symmetry. Their paper proved that it had the R symmetry, it had the supersymmetry, it had the conformal, but it didn't prove it had the conformal symmetry. It was manifest it had a scale symmetry. But from the super Poincaré symmetry and the scale symmetry, you don't deduce the conformal symmetry. The algebra doesn't generate the conformal transformations. So what we verified explicitly, just by classical stuff, is that it had the conformal supersymmetries. That's classical symmetries. It's not hard, but it's not trivial either. And so it's interesting that it works. And once you have the conformal supersymmetries, then the conformal symmetry itself is implied because the anticommutator of two conformal supersymmetries is a conformal symmetry. Modulo gauge transformations and equations of motion, usual sort of story. The other minor contribution we made was to write the sextic potential in a more convenient form. They give the right formula for the potential. But what you want is, what's nice is to write it as a sum of squares, where you can see that the minimum is where the potential is zero, and where it's easy to identify the moduli space, and to see that you're preserving supersymmetry when the potential is zero. So we found a way we were casting it where you could do that.
Are you going to show us the action or something for the?
I wasn't really planning on showing you more of the formula.
So let me just
But it's the same kind of formula I showed you before.
Yeah, so there's a sort of an x to the 6th term, and there's an x squared
right.
Psi squared.
Right, so it's the x to the 6th term is what I was talking about right here.
Mm-hmm. But those are the only terms that
they use. Yeah, same kinds of terms as before, but it's a more general structure. What I didn't write on my transparencies here is, but you may wonder, is how is this related to three algebras? Yeah. And they don't really discuss it in their paper. But in some of the subsequent papers, people do talk about that. And if you write it in the same notation as Bagger-Lambert, the FABCD does not have total antisymmetry. You can define an FABCD, but so the metric is positive definite, but it has less symmetry.
Does it follow up on that? Is it known whether there are additional FABCDs with this less symmetry than positive definite metric if you define new theories beyond what ABJM wrote down?
So at n equals 6, all the n equal 5 and n equals 6 theories have been classified. So the n equal 8, the only one of this general sort is the Bagger-Lambert. Okay? And at n equals 6, I believe the only things are the Well, I told you about UN times UN and SUN times SUN. And there is a generalization. And that is you can have UM times UN and SUM times SUN. So that'd be the most general story for N equals 6 at the field theory level. I'll come back to that. And then I'll also mention about the N equal 5 theory. So the enhancement of the supersymmetry to n equal 8 for k equal 1 and 2 in the ABJM construction, it's got to involve some kind of non-local operations. So they talk about attaching it hoofed lines to operators and stuff like that. And something like that undoubtedly works, but no one's bothered to push it through yet. I haven't tried. It's obviously hard and lazy. Okay. So as I already told you, the ABJM theory for SU2 times SU2 is identical to the BL theory and has the symmetry realized classically. But that's not what we want, because we only want n equal 8 when k is equal to 1 or 2, not when k is greater than 2. So that shows that the BL theory is the wrong theory for 2M2 rings. Now, another important thing that ABJM stressed is that you can express a 7 sphere as an S1 bundle over CP3. It's some standard Hopf-like vibration. And it has an obvious generalization, which I won't bore you with. Because the usual Hopf vibration is S1 over CP1, right, which gives you a 3 sphere. So this is the same sort of thing. And so they write down explicit metric and stuff for this, which I won't present to you. And when you look at the orbifold action in this description, all it does is it rotates this S1 by 2 pi over k. And so the orbifold group just acts on the fiber, effectively reducing the radius of the circle by a factor of k. So that leads to the important observation that when k is large, there's a small circle. And when there's a small circle, you're supposed to say type 2a. So when M theory is compactified in a circle of radius R11, that you get type 2a string theory with a string coupling, which scales like the 3/2 power if you express it in 11-dimensional Planck units. It's the first power if you do it in string units, but 3/2 power if you do it in Planck units. So the radius in this setup is R over K. And we have weakly coupled string theory on ADS4 times CP3. And remember, we had R scaling like Kn to the 1/6. And so we want this to be small, so we want R to be much smaller than K. And so that this formula says that K has to be much bigger than n to the 1/5. So if k is much bigger than n to the 1/5, or if you prefer, you can say that n is much smaller than k to the 5th, in that setup, so if k is large in that way, then you're dealing with type 2a string theory on ADS4 times CP3. And furthermore, the curvature, if you want to use a supergravity approximation, then you want the curvature to be small in string units, and that requires that n is bigger than k. So if you want to use 10-dimensional supergravity, like people often do in the ADS5 times S5 story, then you want to be in this regime here. On the other hand, if you want to talk about M theory, then what you want to be in the M theory setup is you want this radius to be big. And so you want k much less than n to the 1/5. So in particular, you can just put k equal 1. And if you're a large n, then you have a geometric M theory realization.
In the ABJM theory, is there sort of anything obvious which changes when k goes from being less than n to the 1/5 to bigger than n to the 1/5?
Well, it's just whether the circle is bigger or smaller than 1. So
Right, but there's this qualitative change on the gravity side that we can see.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure.
Oh, you mean in the field theory?
In the field theory, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I'm about to talk about the field theory. So the field theory, of course, the coupling constant G squared is 1 over K, right? So 1 over K is the coupling. It corresponds to G squared in a Yang-Mills theory. But you can define the Netouff parameter, N over K. And this works just like the Netouff parameter in N equal 4 Yang-Mills or any four-dimensional gauge theory. It's just that you replace G squared by 1 over K. And the only curious difference between this and the usual Netouff parameter is that it's rational. But otherwise, it's just like things you're familiar with. And so these ABJM theories have a large N expansion in powers of 1 over N at fixed lambda. And this has the usual topological interpretations, completely standard stuff. And so the leading term is the planar approximation, et cetera. And will correspond to the tree approximation in the dual type 2A string. So if you let N and K both get large at fixed lambda, you're in the regime that corresponds to type 2A string. And so you're dealing with type 2A string theory. So it's just like you're familiar with in the ADS5 times S5 story, except you're dealing with ADS4 times CP3. And the other thing that's different is that the supersymmetry is not maximal. It's only 3/4 maximal. So otherwise, it's the same old story. The large N superconformal field theory is weakly coupled for small lambda, and stringy effects of the ADS theory are suppressed for large lambda. Same usual thing. Now, one of the things that bothered people in the past in thinking about M2 brains as a dual description, or for a conformal field theory that's dual to ADS4 times S7, was they could argue that the number of degrees of freedom should scale at large N like N to the 3/2. And so one wondered, how are you ever going to write down a field theory with N to the 3/2 degrees of freedom in it? So ABJM don't completely solve the problem, but they make it clear where the solution lies. And from the bulk theory viewpoint, you can compute the free energy per unit volume associated with these M2 brains. And you find that it's some constant, which involves twos and pis and stuff, which you can provide, but I didn't copy, times m squared over square root of lambda times temperature cubed. And so lambda, remember, is N over K. So if you're looking at fixed lambda and large N, this is proportional to N squared. But that's only limit, remember, where you're supposed to talk about type 2A string theory. In type 2A string theory, you don't have M2 brains, you have D2 brains. And there you know you have N squared degrees of freedom, because that's some super Yang-Mills theory. So N squared is reasonable in that case. On the other hand, if you do fixed K large N, then you're in the M-theory regime where you want the N to the 3/2 behavior. And you can see that that's what you get here. Because, right, because lambda is N over K. Now, the reason this doesn't solve the problem is this analysis is all given from the bulk point of view. And you still want to understand this from the field theory. And that hasn't been done. But this is what has to happen in the field theory.
In the field theory, there must be a smooth lambda to zero limit, right?
Right. So
something like 3/4, you said it's more than that, it's a function of lambda.
Right. So that exactly. You hit the nail on the head. So there is an analog of this in the ADS5 times S5 story, and that there's some function of lambda goes from 1 to 3/4 as you go from one limit to the other. And here the corresponding function is this 1/√ of lambda, basically. So it doesn't just take it between two non-zero constants. It goes to zero in a certain way.
Has that function been computed?
No. Well, from the bulk point of view, this is what it is.
No, I mean.
So it's certainly not understood in the field theory. Well, I guess it's conceptually understood, but It hasn't been. I'm not completely up to date. I don't think it's been done. I'm pretty sure it hasn't. Last I checked, it hadn't been done. So this end of the three has doesn't look like it's going to be a big problem. Now, there are various generalizations of this stuff. So there was this paper by a bunch of Koreans, most of whom are named Lee. So they noted that you can do these n equals 6 theories where your m is not equal to n. But you still have level k and level minus k. That story is carrying through it's all true in all the ABJM theories. You always have a k and a minus k. But then
there's the theory interpretation of that?
Yeah, right. I'm coming to that.
Oh,
And then furthermore, they said there are n equal 5 theories where you have an orthogonal group times a symplectic group with m and 2n and these levels. And the fact, an interesting fact is um times un and om times usp 2n are the bosonic subgroups of supergroups, right? Because you have the unitary supergroups, um slash n, and OSP m slash 2. And that was understood previously for n equal 4 theories in this beautiful work of Gaiato and Witten. So they didn't look at n equal 5 or 6, but they were talking about n equal 4 theories. And what they did was they wrote down all these same kind of interactions with arbitrary coefficients in the interaction terms and showed to get the n equal 4 supersymmetry working that certain quadratic relations had to be satisfied by those coefficients. And those quadratic relations turn out to be precisely the Jacobi identity relations for supergroups. So even though there is no supergroup, these things have nothing to do with symmetries of these theories. It's just that the structure constants of these supergroups appear as couplings in the construction of the Lagrangian. Now, the relevant dualities that allow you to interpret this stuff in M theory or type 2A theory were explained by Aharoni Bergman Jaffaris, ABJ. It turns out that M was in India at the time. So what they found is that, first of all, that this theory is only unitary if M and N don't differ too much. So if they differ by more than k, this is not a unitary conformal field theory. So, and that's not obvious just from looking at it, but it requires a little further thought. And the dual geometry is still this, but there's an additional thing they call torsion flux. And that is when you have this geometry. The S7, when you mod out the S7 by ZK, there's a non-trivial third homology, which is torsion, ZK. So you can wrap stuff on 3 cycles of this, but only up to K times. And so what do you wrap? You have flux. Excuse me, you don't really have flux. So M theory has a three-form potential. So you integrate this three-form potential over this space, and then that you require that basically is a kth root of unity, and that describes the exponential is a kth root of unity, and that defines a torsion, what they call a torsion flux. I don't think calling it a flux is a good name, because it's really more analogous to a Wilson line, just in higher dimensions. Because it's a potential that's being integrated over 3 cycles. So in any case, you can see that torsion element constructed this way can only take k possible values. And so it's reasonable there's some kind of restriction like this, because that covers all the possible values. And so it's interesting that when you exceed that bound, that the theory is not unitary. Of course, in this limit we discussed before, we still get type 2A string theory on ADS 4 times CP3. And in this case, instead of what you're looking at is, remember the 3 form in 11 dimensions decomposes into a 3 form and a 2 form in 10 dimensions. And what you've got is that the 2 form is wrapping a CP1 cycle in the CP3. You don't see any quantization of that, but that's because you're dealing with a large K limit here. Now, you can take these N equals 6 theories and you can do orientifold projection. And it turns out when you do that, you're left with N equals 5 theories. And so the N equals 5 theories have these gauge groups. And so they're dual to M theory or type 2A orientifold theories. And this does lift the M theory, so there's some. So this orientifold notion extends up to 11 dimensions in the appropriate limit. And again, there are restrictions on M and N. However, in this case, there are 4 subcases, depending on whether K is positive. See, K positive and negative have to be distinguished here, because you have 2 different kinds of groups. And also, you have to distinguish whether this M is even or odd. So there are 4 special cases, and so there's a list of inequalities and so on, which I didn't bother copying. But conceptually, the story is the same. In each of those 4 cases, there's a restriction on M minus N that depends on K, and that the precise formula depends whether M is even or odd, and so forth. And the story is essentially the same as what I just described for the N equals 6 theories. And again, it's the same kind of torsion flux when M is not equal to N that's involved. Now, parity symmetry is still present even in these theories. But it's subtle, because remember the parity, when you do the spatial reflection, you get a minus sign on the Chern-Simons theory. But previously, we just interchanged these terms by setting k to minus k, and that's not going to work now. So ABJ argue that there are non-trivial equivalences of superconformal field theories such that it still works. But it's not something that is as obvious as it was before.
Wait, is it obvious in the space-time picture?
I'm told, yes, it is.
Because it's probably a mirror symmetry. The mirror symmetries are often obvious in the space-time picture. But
Yeah. It is obvious. It is obvious in the space-time picture. That requires some thought, but it's relatively obvious. So let me conclude.
When you said it holds due to non-trivial equivalences, do we know that just because of the parity symmetry?
No. They have other arguments for them, which I didn't master, and therefore I'm not prepared to present. But I trust them. They sound reliable. So the various N equal 5 and 6 superconformal field theories in this regime are dual to weakly coupled type 2A superstring on ADS 4 times CP3. With appropriate fluxes. That's one conclusion. And just as in the case of ADS5 CFT4, it's plausible these superconformal field theories are exactly soluble for all lambda in the planar large N limit, and that the dual superstring world sheet theories are also exactly solvable. And so, I use the word solvable, the experts use the word integrable. But so I believe it's been shown that certain conditions for integrability have been demonstrated. But I've always interpreted integrability to mean that if you were clever enough, you could actually solve it. So that's why I use the word solvable. So now, these dualities are definitely harder than the ones in a one higher dimension. The field theories are more complicated. The bulk theories are more complicated. So all these people who are experts on this can take all of their technology and apply it to this new problem, and many of them are doing that. And there's pretty large literature on it already, actually. But they're challenged. It's not just a mindless exercise for them. There are new issues that they have to deal with. So that's nice. because I think that's sort of what they want.
And if we look at this slide again, the interpretation of Hegel's five theories and policies, it was just additional fluxes, or there was more before?
There was this Orientable projection that got you from n equals 6 down to n equals 5. So that's understood both in the bulk and in the field theory construction as well.
And when you said that there's some evidence that the world shape theory is solvable or integrable, that's in the 2A limit?
Right, in the 2A. So only there, because you see this, remember the fixed lambda large n, you're dealing with the string, not M theory. So M theory is still rather elusive, because in the story, it's fixed K, like K equal 1, large N if you wish. But the field theory is just strongly coupled there, and because K is the coupling constant. And so the field theory is tough, the M theory is tough, and that's still true. However, that's what I just say here. However, there is a point that I think is worth making. Anyway, I've chosen to make it. And that is, if you want to describe M theory in, say, flat 11-dimensional spacetime, what is it? Well, there's an answer that's more than 10 years old called matrix theory, which defines M theory as the large N limit of a system of N D0 grains. That's fine. It's right. But now we have an alternative definition as the large N limit of a system of N M2 grains, given by the ABJM theory. And this hasn't really been explored, but this definition can be tested by solving carefully chosen problems. And I suppose this definition could also be tested by choosing carefully chosen problems. And they might be slightly different problems, so maybe it's a worthwhile exercise. But I'm not aware of anyone actually pursuing this idea at the moment.
There is a difference, right? Matrix theory is describing M theory in flat space, and this other approach is describing M theory in ABS4,
Well, well, see, the thing is, if you take K equal 1 and go large N, you're making the radius large. So large N limit, the radius of the sphere will go to infinity.
So it's the same sense in which you would have said that ABS-CFT at large N describes 10-dimensional flat space in terms of D3.
Yes, right. But there we already had a perturbative definition of type 2B string theory, so it didn't seem like such a pressing problem. Here we don't even have something like that for M theory, so.
For
And then as a final remark, there's been absolutely no progress in formulating the six-dimensional superconformal field theory. It's dual to N theory at ABS7 times S4, which I listed in my earlier transparency. And it's generally believed that there's no classical Lagrangian in this case. Nonetheless, I feel in my bones that there ought to be some good way of describing it. And I wish I knew what it was. Okay, that's all.
Has it been checked, for example, that there's no breaking of the superconformal symmetry at the quantum level? I mean, have like beta functions being computed to some
obvious
that
right.
they have to be zero?
Right. So the coupling is given by K, which is an integer. So your first reaction is that integers don't run. But there is still a question, because in turn time series, sometimes one loop corrections will give a shift in K. However, in these theories, it turns out, I haven't done this, but people say that in these theories, the various contributions to these shifts from the scalars, spinners, and gauge fields cancel. So K remains K, even at one loop, and nothing happens beyond one loop. So I think that's all there is to be said on that subject.
Do you have any unsuccessful, unpublished efforts to do the M5 brain?
The answer is yes, but they're so unsuccessful. There's really nothing to be said. I'm not holding anything back.
Okay, so let's thank the speaker again. Okay, so we go to dinner with our week speakers, Stefan Owens and